Hi, I'm Willow Belden, and you're listening to Out There, the podcast that explores big questions through intimate stories outdoors. If you're anything like me, you spend a lot of time thinking about the future, about where you want to end up, what you want to accomplish. And that tendency to look ahead can be a really good thing. It motivates us to do things and make good use of our time. But what happens if you realize the quest to achieve has actually been holding you back? On this episode, producer Noam Osband shares the story of something surprising that happened while he was researching his PhD dissertation. It's a story that takes us from the hills of Arkansas to the forests of Canada, and it shows what happens when you're willing to take your gaze away from your goal.
I know it sounds weird to celebrate finishing a PhD by spending 7 weeks in a swampy Ontario forest, planting thousands of trees a day, covered in bug bites, pissing into a jar. I mean, I think that's paradise, but it's not an obvious paradise. Well, at least it wasn't for me. My story starts 972 miles and 3 decades away in Brookline, Massachusetts. It's a posh Boston suburb, the birthplace of President John F. Kennedy. Nice lawns, low crime. The working parents I knew were mostly professionals. Whenever a kid got injured at the basketball games in my Jewish private school, multiple doctors would jump out from the bleachers to offer help. The school's sports teams were literally called the MCATs, a pun on the med school entrance exam. The only real kind of achievement was overachievement. As early as 4th grade, I'm stressing in my diary about getting into Harvard. And I went there, as did 10% of my graduating class. After finishing undergrad, I told people, I'm going to go back to grad school. I just don't know what for. This mindset, this need to achieve, it is so deeply ingrained within me. And it spills over into other parts of my life. Whenever I'm traveling, even if it's a car ride of just a few minutes or 2 subway stops, I always need a book or a podcast, something to take advantage of my time. What's the point of just mindlessly looking out the window? This approach, however, it's got drawbacks. When we're driving down the highway, we don't usually stop for those odd, intriguing attractions that catch our eye.
Oh my gosh! It's the National Metal Museum!
We usually drive right by, trying to make good time.
Oh no, girl, we gotta get going.
But on the rare occasion, we actually stop and get out. Isn't that sometimes the best part of the trip? I started graduate school 4 years after finishing college. My PhD dissertation was all about migrant workers planting trees. Now, when I say tree planting, I don't mean hippy-dippy plant a tree on Earth Day planting. I mean America is the world's largest producer of wood products, and we plant over 1.5 billion trees a year in the United States. Well, not we. Tree planters do. Most of America's tree planters are foreign-born. America's largest reforestation companies all rely on Latin American guest workers, men who leave behind homes and families to enter the country on temporary visas. H-2B visas, to be specific. It's the same visa Trump uses to get workers for his vineyards. For my dissertation research, I'd arranged with one such company to join a crew of Mexican planters to plant trees as a regular employee. Us anthropologists often describe our research method as deep hanging out. And that's exactly what I planned on doing. I'd plant with them during the day and go back with them to the motel at night, even sharing a bed with someone just like everybody else. I'd also film the experience since my dissertation was a documentary. I could have gotten my PhD without actually planting myself, but I figured I'd learn more from doing. And quite frankly, I wanted the challenge. I'd done yard work before, but I'd never done anything like tree planting. The concept of manliness, it is deeply problematic. But if I'm just being real, I simply wanted to put away the books, plant in a field, and feel like a man. I started research in January 2013, traveling from Oaxaca to Arkansas on a bus full of planters. Nearly 50 men, and I didn't know a soul. I stuck out. Partly because I was American, partly because I had a video camera, and partly because someone had started a rumor that I was an undercover agent. The crew was me, 12 other planters, and a foreman. We typically get to the field by sunrise, often working till sundown. We'd plant in rows, spacing trees 6, 7, maybe 8 feet apart. You carry the saplings in a bag on your back, and these guys typically loaded up 1,000 trees at once. That's over 50 pounds. So you're not just planting, but you also have a load to carry. Sometimes you're lucky, and you're planting soft ground in a clear field. Other times, you have to hack your way through thorns and briars, or the ground is full of rocks. Most guys planted at least 3,000 trees a day. Highballers, 4 or 5,000. Even if you're careful, there's no good way to put your body through that punishment. I've heard many planters talk about waking up with their fingers clenched into a fist and prying them open to start the day. My first day was a chilly winter morning in Georgia. We got to the site at sunrise, and I knew the workday would end with darkness. And it could not have ended soon enough. I'd never been so tired or thirsty in my life. I stood in the field midday, stared up at the sun, and desperately willed it to go down faster than I knew it would. I only planted 1,100 trees. I got back to the motel and collapsed on the dirty carpet, listlessly watching crappy TV. Yet, I'm an optimist. I figured I'd adapt. I told some guys it wouldn't be long till I had my first 2,000 tree day. Ha! I quit planting 2 weeks later. On my best day, I only got in 1,500. I told myself I was quitting because I wasn't getting any filming or research done. I was too tired to take out my camera and write notes after planting all day. But I was also physically and emotionally drained. My wrist was killing me, and no amount of ibuprofen was helping. Honestly, I was happy to stop planting. Of course, I had the privilege to quit. I had a research stipend. But the crew didn't have that privilege. Instead, they had other things. Like Otoniel, who had a deep gash in his foot made by the planting shovel. And Arturo, well, he didn't have a grant, but he had a daughter in the hospital with the flu. One night we drove around late, desperately looking for a place to send money home. And Rudolfo, my bedmate, well, he had a loan he took out to pay for his wife's C-section. These guys planted for months and months, rain and shine. They accepted my presence and my questions, but they never let me forget my boast I'd get to 2,000 trees. I recognized my good fortune. Even though Rodolfo slept diagonal most nights, I never moved his legs. He needed all the rest he could get. To stay on their good side, I became El Aquador, the water boy. I'd walk around all day with a knapsack full of water bottles to offer them. There is no better way to get on a planter's good side than to offer them water when they're 2,000 trees into a 70-degree day. I'm happy these guys get this work. And they are too. It lets them buy land and build homes. The American dollar goes far in the Oaxacan countryside. But it's a crappy life. You don't do it because you like it. You do it out of necessity. Spending time with the crew made me more grateful than ever before for being born into an environment where both my parents slept at home each night. Grateful for the dumb, unearned luck of financial security and the gift of choice. I didn't have to do a job I hated. I had options. The options I knew about, at least. But as I was soon to discover, those weren't the only options out there.
Hey, it's Willow again. We'll get back to the story in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor. Support for this episode comes from Thrive Market, making healthy living easy and affordable for everyone. Thrive Market is an online store that sells the same kind of organic products you could find at, say, Whole Foods, but for less money. You can get everything from vitamins to beauty products to fresh seafood, all shipped straight to your door, and prices are up to 30% less than retail. Speaking of shipping, Thrive Market is committed to zero waste, so all their packaging, boxes, and inserts are made from recycled paper and are themselves recyclable. Because you're listening to this podcast, Thrive Market has a special deal for you. You can take 25% off your first order and get a 30-day free trial when you go to thrivemarket.com/out there. That's thrivemarket.com/out there. And of course, Thrive Market's prices are already up to 30% off retail. With this offer, you can get an additional 25% off your first order. Again, that's at thrivemarket.com/out there. And as always, we have a link to that on our website. And now, back to the story.
There aren't many American planters left, but there are a few. And for the next stage of research, I turned my focus to them. I joined up with a crew of 18 planters on a rainy and windy January night. I knew the foreman, but I didn't know anyone else. I found the planters hanging out in a hay barn, talking, laughing, and passing around some handles of hard liquor. Most were in their 20s or 30s. I walked in and sheepishly said,
"Hey, my name is Noam. I'm an anthropologist. I'll be living with you guys for the next month."
It was as awkward as it sounds. Really painfully awkward. There's no good way to tell someone, "You didn't know this, but now you're my research subject." They warily gave me a space in their circle. I wasn't past the bottle with enthusiasm. People asked me directly if I was an undercover narcotics officer. Unlike the Mexican planters, this group was a mix of men and women. Rather than living in motels, they stayed on the camping site, a motley crew of cars, tents, trucks, and trailers. A lot of planters lived out of their vehicles full time. When one guy told me he'd been living out of his SUV for years, I thought, that's crazy. I mean, living out of a camping shell on a pickup is one thing. But living out of a mid-sized car, that's nuts. Cluttered. Uncomfortable. You gotta go outside just to take a dump. I remember the first time it began to make sense. The day started inauspiciously. A snowstorm had moved in overnight, and I woke up to find my tent collapsing under a heavy layer of ice and snow. I rushed outside in long johns to save it. Most of us went to stay at a motel in town, and that night we went out to a Mexican restaurant. Late in the evening, one of the planters, named Phil, got into a brief scuffle with a local. Afterwards, the man turned to Phil, offered a handshake, and said,
"Well, maybe we talk again, or maybe not."
Phil refused to shake his peace offering.
"I don't think so,"
he said.
"I'm just passing through your town. I have freedom, and I move where I want."
The violence in Phil's fists and voice unnerved me. but his words, they intrigued me. Up to that point, I'd only been focused on what these guys didn't have. The fact they lacked a mainstream job, employer-based healthcare, a permanent address. What I hadn't considered was what they did have, what they enjoyed about the job, what they saw that I did not. The work sites where this crew lived and planted were pretty remote. Places you can only get to by driving down a dirt road, which is itself a spur off another dirt road. I'd never been so isolated in my life. The universe gets distilled down to this small patch of forest where you spend every day and night. I began to lose track of time. I couldn't remember if it was a weekday or the weekend, and there was no motel TV to remind me. And I found this confusion unexpectedly liberating. Permit me a small anthropological aside. Historians tell us the turn to capitalism and the nation-state completely reoriented our relationship to time. If we're going to have large factories with precise work schedules or railroad timetables for trains covering long distances, we need precise ways to measure time. Clocks didn't even have minute hands till the late 1600s, and it wasn't until the 1700s and 1800s that clocks and watches became household items. Our days used to start and end with the sun. Now, we do time in precise divisions of hours, minutes, and seconds. Our natural rhythms are hardly natural. And when you're living on tree planter time, cut off from those normal rhythms, your needs and wants are fewer, simpler. There aren't so many distractions. It's like being a monk without the monastery. Away from the 24/7 news cycle and living for months out of a tent, I had never felt so intimately connected to nature. I saw what a field looks like at dawn when everything's frosted over with a thin layer of ice, and I'd watch its crystal beauty melt as the temperature rose. When the wind picked up, I could stop what I was doing and just take it in, hear it build from a low rumble into a powerful rustle, and watch the treetops dancing. I'd be climbing over logs, walking through mud, sometimes even falling in it. I don't get to do that so much as an adult. At night, we'd usually have a fire, sit around and talk. There's a lot of nights to pass, so you chat about anything and everything. Sometimes there's music, a bottle or a joint gets passed around, usually both. You're spending day after day with the same people, so you bond. And that night sky, the stars. Often, before entering my tent to sleep, I'd look up at a Milky Way just oozing celestial beauty, and I'd feel so darn lucky. Hell, I even came to change my mind on car living. Spike had a Volvo station wagon with room for a mattress, a camping stove, even a well-stocked spice rack. He was comfy. I know I'm making this sound like Eat, Pray, Love set in the woods. But for the people who choose to plant, the people who love this job, it kind of is like that. All year long, I see tree planter buddies on Facebook looking forward to reuniting with their planting family back out in the field. This October, I was at a radio conference and I sat at a table of strangers for lunch. One business executive mentioned that she had planted trees years earlier. She told everyone it was one of the best times of her life. People seemed confused, except me. I understood her huge, radiant smile. I understood her choice. That's the key word here. Choice. Unlike many of us, these planters had very consciously and intentionally chosen their lives. They had the kind of education that gave them options, but they wanted to plant. They liked being part of a small tribe of dirty travelers, being their own boss, working as hard as they want and getting paid precisely for their efforts. Some planters were in their 50s and 60s, and they'd been doing migrant work for decades. There's a whole migrant cycle if you want it. After you plant trees, you can do corn detasseling in Iowa, beets in Montana, apples in New York, cranberries in Maine. You follow the work. This simple life provides these guys with all they need. It's like Bob Dylan said, a man is a success if he gets up in the morning and gets to bed at night, and in between, he does what he wants to do. Spending time with these planters made me feel so conventional. I was someone who had always approached life by asking, is this a good move for the future? Will taking this job or working on this project help me get ahead? Ugh, that phrase, get ahead. Ahead of what? Ahead of whom? I'd always excelled academically, and it seemed natural I'd become a professor. I'd never approached professional life by saying, what do you love? What do you enjoy? And I'd never been surrounded before by people who approached life that way either. Listen, I know that hearing some Harvard schmuck complain about too much schooling is the most insufferable of first world problems. But there's also something universal, something that transcends time, place, culture, and class, about realizing maybe you don't want the lifestyle that you've been taught all this time is the good life. In 2014, I moved to New York City to edit my dissertation and return to my normal. I spent a lot of time watching my footage, and I found myself missing mornings that started not with an alarm, but when dawn broke into my tent. I missed nights spent swapping stories around a fire. And I really wanted to be back out there. And this time, not to work on a PhD, not to focus on some long-term project, but just to be. To be out in the woods and just plant. To change my view from the horizon to the ground beneath my feet. And so, 2 months after finishing my PhD, I headed back out to the bush to spend a season planting. I was excited, but to be honest, part of me felt self-indulgent, irresponsible. By this time, I had decided to pursue a career in radio, to take a chance at something I loved rather than something that seemed predestined. Planting for 2 months meant 2 months without pitching or producing or networking, 2 months without achieving. Was that wise? And it seemed that if I'd learned anything at all after nearly 10 years of graduate school, it was that it was okay, maybe even the right decision, to watch the sunrise, hear the wind, feel the rain, rather than land a pitch. I went to plant in Northern Ontario. Here's a funny difference between America and Canada. In America, no one knows what tree planting is. In Canada, everyone does. It's a common job for college kids on summer break, a beloved Canadian rite of passage. I'd learned about Canada's tree planting scene a few years prior when I went up north for a week of dissertation research. On that trip, I'd again inserted myself without knowing anybody, meeting the crew in town on their off day. As I only discovered later, I apparently showed up on the same day someone had received a large shipment of hallucinogens in the mail, a package most of the planters had shared. I just thought folks were hula-hooping naked because they were relaxing on their off day. Silly me. People were suspicious of my timing. Yet again, some folks openly wondered if I was a narc. People up there worked hard and partied hard. kind of like Bizarro summer camp for manual laborers. And just like the emotional intensity of camp, you bond real quickly and real closely. I loved the vibe there. And so several years later, when I decided to plant a season, that's where I went. It took 2 days and 21 hours of driving to reach the planting site. We camped in the middle of a large forest, at least an hour drive from any town. No cell reception, no internet, no communication with the outside world, except the every 5 or 6 days that we got a day off in town. I was the oldest person by over a decade. One planter, a teenager, informed me that I was the same age as his dad. Another planter told me how lucky I was that I got to live through the glory years of The Simpsons. My first day planting was my birthday. I was proud of myself for having gotten back to tree planter time. It was the perfect present. It did not feel perfect a few hours later when a lightning storm moved in, pouring down onto the muddy field where we all held our metal shovels. I had a devil of a time at first just getting to 1,500 trees a day, and I soon developed a pain in the behind that hurt each time I bent over. I was uncomfortable out there. I was also uncomfortable when I went to a pharmacy to ask for the pain reliever Anisole. It was my first time using a suppository. That's a fancy word for butt pill. I asked the pharmacist if it was hard to insert the medicine. He stared back blankly and astutely responded, "I don't know what your bum is like." I also wasn't prepared for the black flies of Northern Ontario. Nothing prepares you for the black flies of Northern Ontario. They are so many and so vicious that people actually write folk songs about them. Our faces got so swollen that we all looked like part of some insane forest-dwelling cult. In order to avoid opening my tent flap at night, I started sleeping with a metal water bottle that I'd used to pee in. But you know, butt pain, bug bites and all, it was one of the happiest periods of my life. I'd wake every day at 6, eat, jump on the bus, and just plant. I didn't have to think about much else. Some days, I barely saw anyone else out there. Just me, all alone in a large field. It's funny how feeling so small under a vast sky can make you feel so large. That summer of planting was the most present-focused period of my life. Some folks do Zen retreats, and apparently I go tree planting. A few weeks before the season ended, I finally hit my first 2,000 tree day. I had really good land, and my crew boss let me stay out late to hit the mark. When I got back to the group, I was unexpectedly emotional. It seemed like things had come full circle from years earlier. I took off my shirt, walked down a dirt road, and felt the breeze waft over my chest. I took a moment to reflect on the unlikely journey that took me from Brookline, Massachusetts, to some spot in the Canadian wild that you can only locate with a GPS. And I felt blessed for having discovered the world of planting and a self-understanding that all my years of book learning couldn't provide. Ultimately, the season ended and I headed back to New York. I love this city and all it offers. I'm not planning on leaving here anytime soon. But I'm also aware the pace of New York, it's insane. It's a city of striving and dreaming. You kill yourself working hard and then you look around and it seems like everyone is doing it better. It's difficult for me to not always think, you should work harder. But sometimes, not as often as I want, but sometimes, when I worry that I'm not getting enough done or moving ahead as fast as I want, I think back to the woods, to tree planting time, to that mindset. Fifth Avenue, it's not the same as a field of pines, but I can still walk slow. I can still look up, hear the sounds around me, and feel lucky.
That was Noam Osband. He's a producer and musician living in Brooklyn. He often makes things under the moniker The Nosy Anthropologist, and you can see more of his work at noamosband.com. That's N-O-A-M, osband.com. Music for this story included works from Muse Open. I have a couple of announcements coming up, but first, I want to ask for a quick favor. If you'd be so kind, would you pause the podcast for just a moment and text a friend the link to this episode? Word of mouth is one of the best ways we can grow, and this is a very real way you can support the show without spending any money. So please, take a moment and send this link to someone who you think would enjoy the story you just heard. Okay, it's time now for Community Classifieds. Our classifieds section is a way for all of you to let each other know about events, books, products, etc., that you think the Out There community would enjoy. Today's classified ad comes from Mountain Literary. When you're home planning your next adventure, or sitting in front of the fireplace, and you're wishing you had something new and unique to read, consider Mountain Literary, where you can find the Mountaintop series of novels by William Graney and a selection of used adventure books. Featured novels include The Ways of Autumn, which won a gold medal in the 2018 Human Relations Indie Book Awards, and the 2017 silver medal winner called Mountain Time. Book descriptions and links to purchase can be found at mountaintopusa.com. That's mountaintopusa.com. If you'd like to take out a classified ad of your own, just head over to our website, outtherepodcast.com, and click Contact. There's a super easy form to fill out, and as soon as we hear from you, we'll be in touch about all the details. Before you go, I have two quick announcements to make. First, I wanted to thank everyone who's gotten in touch with us about our episode on diversity. We've gotten wonderful suggestions about how to make the show more inclusive, which we're adding to the list of ideas we already had. We can't wait to start putting them into action. So stay tuned, we'll have lots more details about our plans coming up. The other thing I wanted to say is that we just got a new shipment of Out There merchandise. We're all stocked up on t-shirts, hoodies, and stickers, and we also have brand new Out There coffee mugs. Head over to our website, outtherepodcast.com, and click on the merch tab to take a look. The money you spend on Out There gear goes directly to paying for the stories on this show. Finally, a big thank you to Ben Wolfe, Bill Burke, Ken Johnson, Deb and Vince Garcia, Sam Shapinski, and Lisa King for their financial contributions to Out There. You all make this show possible. That's it for this episode. Our marketing and business development director is Alex Eggerking. Laura Johnston heads up our ambassador program. And our theme music was written by Jared Arnold. Have a beautiful day, be bold, go outside, and find your dreams.